welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. Maybe Trump will start getting this. Maybe he will recognize that he just can't spend. Now, enforcing the Constitution, he can spend that money. But when it comes to violating the Constitution, he is equally culpable or equally guilty of transgressing against the Constitution, i.e., his previous transgressions in his previous presidency by spending money on vaccinations. That is not an enumerated power. Now, let me also get into the concept that we need to make an appeal to heaven. And I would implore you, I would basically, I don't want to admonish, but I want to encourage people, you know, I understand that there's a lot of people like myself that don't like necessarily doing public prayer. I mean, if you're having a meeting, I think it's always best in a meeting to start off with an invocation and maybe a benediction for the meeting. But just to openly pray, we're advised by the scriptures not to do that and to provide those prayers as a public record or a you know, something that's a part of the document. This is one of the reasons why many of our meetings are always kicked off with a prayer, and I never record that, because that is specific appeal to heaven for those in that meeting to basically, you know, listen up and hear the advice and guide and so forth. Anyway, so I understand that there's probably a lot of people that don't like to or possibly won't do prayer circles, but I do know that there are a lot of people that do believe in making those appeals to heaven in a public forum or with, you know, other people to kind of have a prayer circle. I'm not necessarily against that. As a matter of fact, I encourage it, because I always encourage that appeal to heaven, just like going all the way back to John Locke, who made those statements that, you know, when all else fails, we have the right and must appeal to heaven. He's listening. I mean, he listened and listened and listened. And, you know, to Israel in Egypt, not the Jews, but to Israel in Egypt. The Jews were just 1/12 of Israel at that point in time. So if you are willing to initiate your own group, and as a matter of fact, there's a lot of groups that I work with now, I would encourage them, each of their leaders or what have you, to say, you know what, we need to have maybe a daily or a weekly prayer, or, you know, meeting once a month, something. Start including an appeal to heaven. Now, if you want to join the Loudoun Liberty Appeal to Heaven, which is every day, the information is on my Red State Talk Radio podcast page. And if you want to open up your prayer circle, your appeal to heaven, just send me the information. I will include that. I'm making a point every day to try to, you know, help motivate people to, you know, doing this, because we can't do this without him. Just like Benjamin Franklin pointed out that a bird, you know, heaven recognizes and sees and knows every time a bird falls from the heaven. There's not anything that can happen without heaven knowing. And therefore, how vain were they in their day to think that they could raise up a nation or a union without the appeal to heaven, without seeking his help. They had already tried this twice before with the Articles of Association. And I'm not saying that they weren't praying men and they weren't godly men, but they didn't pray for his hand deliberately. I mean, that was a stark difference when they all got together and prayed. And so this is one of the things that to me is a testament that this is why I can see his providence in this Constitution. So Let me also say the good old obligatories as they come. And the final one is your campaign needs to begin today. You need to start your campaign and start holding people accountable. You need to get champions on the Constitution, for the Constitution. And, you know, if we can get people in public office to do this, then we're ahead of the game. That right there is the key. Now, we have a very focused show today, and it may actually bleed into the Monday, if necessary. But this is an appeal to Trump. This is an appeal to heaven. This is an appeal to you, because we have what we need in the Constitution. And unfortunately, see, I mean, Trump was being victimized by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment when it did not apply to him. The only thing that applies to presidents in holding them accountable is the impeachment process. Section 3 did not want to amend and change that process because that was ingrained and galvanized in the Constitution and has been used ever since. And it works, kind of. Actually, there's been way too many times when Congress has failed to actually exercise that because of the corruption of Congress and because of the corruption of the court. And so, see, with a president, you can actually, you know, make a president change. And I'll give you a couple of cases in point. I believe that we all know that Lincoln was one that, you know, changed his heart. He didn't completely change. He was still a tyrant, but he changed the focus of the war, which is what needed to happen. I see that there's a possibility that Trump can change his tone, his tenor, and his presidency to one being of a constitutional manner in getting and understanding that every person in office is legally bound to support the Constitution, not their agenda and so forth. So we're going to lay a case out because I want to focus on his executive order regarding the citizenship. And so we're going to dive into what he said and the law and what he needs to do. And you've heard me say this, that the Department of Justice needs to be completely rebuilt. It needs to be retooled to become the Department of Justice in ensuring public servants are absolutely honoring and fulfilling their oath of office by supporting this Constitution, not the annotated Constitution, the Constitution for the United States of America, the original text, not the redefined text. And as a matter of fact, we'll get into this in the executive order. So all of that being said, we're in a situation where the globalist shills, like the Bushes, Clintons, Obamas, and Bidens, and their minions through the different party ranks and organizations, corporations, and so forth, have been committing an insurrection against the Constitution, and we, the people, must demand that they be fully held accountable. We cannot allow these infractions to continue against the Constitution. We're on the ropes, folks. We're on the precipice of falling as a nation because we have lost sight of this one little key thing that every citizen is legally responsible, regardless of what you think. You can be compelled to take up arms to support and defend that Constitution. When we're functioning under that Constitution, every citizen has that legal obligation. If you take a conscientious objection, there are different processes in handling that. We get that. You can conscientiously object to killing a person, but that does not mean you can abdicate your responsibility in supporting the Constitution, which is one of the reasons why they actually went down this path of, okay, you don't have to pull the trigger, but you'll become a medic, you'll become, you know, an admin, because they don't need everybody to pull the trigger or be involved in the administering of death, right, in a war. So anyway, we're at that point where we have to hold everybody accountable. And there's a huge danger of populism and anarchy. Populism and anarchy kind of go hand in hand, and it all falls under the umbrella of a democratic form of government, where the people, you know, create, and it's the squeaky wheel is really what happens. Because when you really look, and I don't believe the outcome of this past election was accurate. I think that we got a good insight to what was more accurate than the 2020 election, no doubt. But I think the real reason was they didn't take a break. They didn't go to bed and let the numbers sit out there to allow the evil who never sleeps to change the numbers. And actually, while everybody's waking up, they came up with the canned excuse of how all of these things happened and how Kamala Harris was now president. While we woke up and go, what the heck happened? This is why you have to understand evil never sleeps, and we can't sleep either when there's an outcome pending. Now, sometimes, you know, these outcomes can go, but we need to have people on the watch and engaged to make sure everybody wakes up so that they understand what's happening. And so the election, I truly believe we need to take the election back. And I think that should be, and I believe it's going to be a part of President Trump's policies, hopefully. Hopefully. I don't want to be a sycophant. I don't want to be a fan. I'm not a fanatic of any person. The only man that has walked on the face of the earth that I'm a fan of, and that's Jesus Christ. So, that being said, the danger of speaking out in today's environment, like the Alien Sedition Acts, has really taken a turn. Because a week ago, anybody that spoke out against the president and the government and the evil doings that they're doing and calling them out for these violations of the Constitution, you were really at risk. And I believe today that it has really taken a turn. Not that it's, you know, free game here or anything else, but I do believe that the conservative voice, the constitutional voice, can actually be heard today. I still believe that the globalists have not gone away. I just believe that the reins are in the hands of another man that is presenting the paradigm that we're now safe for the next couple of years. The only way that this can actually change to where we actually are safe for generations to come is holding people accountable. I'm going to go right back to holding every person accountable that it has an oath of office. If they're not fulfilling that oath by supporting the Constitution, then they need to be removed. And every citizen, we need, and we'll dive into this, how citizens need to be aware. If it's one thing to support an amendment to the Constitution, say the Constitution needs to change, we all have to understand and accept that the law is fixed. That federal constitution is fixed. We don't just get an agenda, you know, the parties to compromise themselves into new powers. That can't happen. That is unconstitutional. And therefore, the dialogue must be, and you need to really sell it so the 3/4 of the states buy into it, why you want to have a national health care program. Because I'm telling you right now, that will never pass 3/4 of the states. Even though we got one rammed down our throats, we already see the evils that have come with this. So, as we go into today, one of the things that I want to focus on, because this is all about the citizenship, I want to clarify something. Because the federal government, over the course of the past several decades, has gotten into the habit, or has basically assumed the power of the importation of people. Now, clearly, the importation of persons or people was granted to the states alone in Article 1, Section 9, where the federal government was prohibited from getting involved in the state's temporary ability for the importation of persons. The federal government was never given that grant. As a matter of fact, the only delegation to the federal government regarding citizens and people immigrating into the United States was that they had the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. nowhere to grant citizenship, or I should say, nowhere where they could actually grant access to America through refugees, through any form of importations of people, block importations, or opening up the border and saying, hey, if you're coming from this border, you can get here and we're going to help you. They couldn't do that. They can't do that. They're prohibited from doing these things. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution is clear that when people start crossing that border, they must be repelled. If it's a one person, a group, a family, it doesn't matter. The definition of an invasion is any person that wants to come. The invader must be repelled. If you're a trespasser here, this is tantamount to being an invader. You can actually perform warfare, not just military warfare. There's political warfare. There's cultural warfare. There's all sorts of different warfare that can be unleashed and undermine the good people, our culture, and our Constitution. So therefore, we need to put things into true perspective, that the federal government's responsibility is to have a uniform rule of naturalization. Now, one of the things that was happening after the Constitution was ratified was this problem of slavery and the 14th Amendment. And I've been doing extensive research, and there's no doubt in my mind I willfully and am capable of proving that 14th Amendment is not your boogeyman. There's no language within that 14th Amendment that basically says we're going to subjugate the citizens of the United States to less than real citizens, that they've become property of the United States. That language is not there. You have to be completely oblivious to understanding the debates in Congress. You might find some people alluding to this that were the opponents to the amendment. Just because an opponent said disparaging comments to do anything that they could for allowing that amendment to pass doesn't mean that what they were saying was legally binding or an actual term and definition of that amendment. So be careful when you're reading anything from an opponent, because those opponents were using very good sophistry in their language to kind of make it seem like, you know, that it's interesting that we're doing this, but this is what's going to happen. They weren't trying to ratify. They were trying to stop this amendment from happening. And it was such a minority. But when you read the debates in Congress, as Professor Lash points out, that the negative comments were equal to and very voluminous in comparison to, you know, the rest of the comments, the positive comments. They were equally voluminous. So just because they had that many negative comments didn't mean that they had that many people that were actually buying into it. Because the 14th Amendment was ratified, or I should say passed, by both houses of Congress very quickly. I don't think it even went to a second vote. I think the only thing was that they wanted to make sure that the language was perfect. And it took them about 2 months to do this. About 2 months. I think they started in April. And as a matter of fact, I'd done the research and I wanted to do a lot of the research on the 14th Amendment and Section 1 of the 14th Amendment in particular. And as a matter of fact, I'll dive into that. But what we need to talk about, what we need to really understand, is that President Trump's EOs, executive orders, cannot be declaring law. President Trump has to be very careful that he does not violate the Constitution by trying to declare or redefine the law. What he has to do is he actually has to point to how the law has been perverted and violated in its essence by its original definitions, because he came close in his EOs to hitting some of this, but he failed to point to the court that really caused the problem. Because the anchor baby and the redefining of a citizen born, or a person born in the United States to becoming a citizen, that redefinition started in the 1960s. This was when the concept of an anchor baby was thrown into and redefining the 14th Amendment, Section 1. So when we, you know, kind of look at his executive order, the executive order is titled Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship. Now, what I'm going to do, instead of diving into all of my research, what I'm going to do is kind of dive into parts of this, starting off from the top, and we're going to work our way through. I want to go through the nuts and bolts of this, because one, you deserve to hear the words that were written, and two, you need to understand why those words need to change or how to bolster, fortify, and buoy up the case to make it irrefutable so that the states, when they actually hear, because who are the final arbiters over what is to be constitutional? Is it the Supreme Court? No. The final arbiters are the state legislatures. And I am confident that if we made an appeal to all of the state legislatures today, we might have some problems. And I say that because there's so many rhinos in the party, or I should say in the state legislatures, such as South Dakota, such as, you know, many of the states. Many of the red states have rhinos. Wyoming has cleaned up a lot of them. I'm not convinced that, I'm being told that they have enough gone that they can actually have substantial legislation. So what really has to happen, and this is why I go back to, and I'm going to repeat myself probably a few times today, and I'm going to keep on saying this over the next few months, if not the next few years, President Trump needs to retool the Department of Justice to hone its focus on public servants and their oath of office and whether they are supporting the Constitution's original intent and meaning by the definitions provided at the time when those words were being considered and amended to the Constitution, i.e. the ratification debates and or the establishment of those amendments, and how those amendments were pounded out in passing Congress for moving forward. So, in his executive order, Protecting the Meaning and Value of an American Citizen, by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, it is hereby ordered. Section 1, Purpose. The privilege of the U.S. citizenship is a priceless and profound gift. I don't know about the platitudes. I don't like to see those things, but, you know, that's what people do. They like to make people feel good. The 14th Amendment states, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, close quote. The next part of this paragraph is key because he makes a real failure here. That provision rightly repudiated the Supreme Court of the United States, a shameful decision in the Dred Scott v. Stanford, 60 U.S. 19 Howard 393, 1857 case, which misinterpreted the Constitution as permanently excluding people of African descent from eligibility for United States citizenship solely based on their race. Here's the problem with this first paragraph. They're not pointing out that the court could not make law or make that declaration. That power is not vested in the courts. That power is not vested in the judges. They cannot create law. So the court and its rulings, the Taney Court and its rulings in this Dred Scott case, was a direct violation, and that's what he should be calling it out. Not that it was a shameful thing, it was a violation, and Congress at that time should have stepped in and removed Taney. Yeah, they should have removed Cheney as well as soon as he started going rogue. But okay, we have a responsibility of holding everybody accountable. So I'm going to take a pause because we're going to go into break here. But I want you to think, when things are occurring in a venue, we have an obligation, responsibility, that if a person is beginning to champion an unconstitutional footing, an unconstitutional idea, to get it to make headway and to actually create a case like this, or to actually start moving a bill and getting people to passing laws that are unconstitutional, it is the duty of every person under oath to say, hold on here, what you're talking about is a violation of the Constitution. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so there was nothing keeping people before the 14th Amendment from holding each other accountable. And as a matter of fact, I believe that the framers, when you really read their discussions regarding the oath of office, they thought that this was so brilliant. This was a godsend. Never, ever before did they have a mechanism that would actually hold people accountable. And Madison really understood. There's no doubt in my mind that Madison truly understood the problems that were inherent in mankind. And in Federalist Papers, I only cite Federalist Papers not as defining the law, but in some of the theories, because they were struggling with these theories of governance and why they crafted the Constitution the way they did. So it's an insightful document. But I would love to see Trump basically say the Supreme Court, or I should say, in no way or any form can the Federalist Papers be used to justify a decision. The only documents that can be used to justify a legal decision is the ratification debates of the Constitution and or the debates in Congress of the proponents for the amendments, of how they were defining that amendment to go forth to the states for ratification. Those are the only legally binding terms and definitions, folks. That's it. You can't come along and redefine it. Now, in the very beginning days, I'm going to expound on this, in the very beginning days of Congress, Congress had the responsibility of kind of defining things, at like making a uniform rule, and so they created those definitions of doing so. The Republican form of government, those types of things that either they dove into or they at least decided to follow the original intent. Problem is, some things were not really well written down, i.e. the Republican form of government. So the states really need to redefine this. And Why Counties Matter Most lays out what and how the states need to redefine this. But the states themselves, the state legislatures themselves, will have to be willing, just like the federal, or I should say the state government, in creating the federal government, this general government, they have to basically allow themselves to become general governments themselves. You got to remember, the Continental Congress, these men were good men, and they loved the Constitution because it was going to fix the problem. And they were willing to step down from Continental Congress and their duties as such to see a new government erected. The problem was the cabals in the state legislatures would not have allowed this to happen. The only way it happened was because it was debated by the people in conventions, of a Republican form conventions. In other words, the people elected. when you hear that it was debated by the people in convention, you think that, oh, well, all these people came, you know, from every corner of the state and came to this big hall and they debated it. No. They elected representatives and delegates, and it was broken down to a level of representation. And I'm going to say that it was better representation than the representation in Congress, or I should say in the state legislature. If you look at the Virginia delegates, there were far more delegates in the Virginia debates for the ratification than there were in the state legislature, because the people wanted to make sure that they had better representation. My point is that as we kind of look at the 14th Amendment, as we look at how things were moving forward at that point in time, and because just to go back at what I said, Trump should have basically said that the Taney Court was wrong, and actually he can say that. At the time when, prior to the 14th Amendment, Congress really didn't have the power to invoke Section 3 of the 14th Amendment because it didn't exist. But they did have this innate honor and responsibility of honor. And they should have called out, and there should have been a formal protest. And actually, Congress would have had the right of basically nullifying that law by the court, because it was a violation of separations of power. And this is where the investigative powers of Congress could have pulled everybody in and goes, where in the Constitution do you have the authority to do this, to create law? Because what you just did was you created law. And that's the whole point of what Trump needs to do in that very first paragraph. Now, let me go through Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Section 3 states that no person shall be. In other words, if you are, you can't be anymore. They don't say this. What they say is no person shall be a senator, representative in Congress. In other words, a federal representative or an elector of the president or vice president. So you can't be a federal representative, meaning senator, elector, and representative. So let's just kind of condense this out. No person shall be a federal representative or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of this whatever position, as an officer of the states or a member of any state, period, because they go into, now they go into, in this part right here, they go into member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature. So in other words, they're using a different set of words to redefine this, you know, what they put in the front end, because they actually go down and dive into a little bit further into the state or any judicial officer of any state. So they dive into that. And bottom line, anybody that has to take an oath to support the Constitution as an oath of office, that person cannot be in their office if, while they're in office and they violate their oath of office by supporting an insurrection or a rebellion against the Constitution or giving aid and comfort to those that are doing it, then they are to be immediately removed. Now, here's the thing. The Department of Justice, and the way this was defined, there is no due process. This right here is a standard. In other words, it's a qualification. You have to be a natural-born citizen to be the President of the United States. For you to maintain your office, if you've taken an oath to the Constitution, in whatever office that is, barring the President of the United States, if you've taken an oath while you're in office and you have violated that oath by either violating the Constitution or giving aid and comfort to those that are, then you are ineligible to continue any service moving forward at that point in time of the violation. Therefore, when we really break this down, this person is to be escorted out. They're to be stripped of all access. They're to be stripped of everything. And as a matter of fact, they are no longer eligible for pay. technically, we could actually go and strip a lot of people that have been getting away with violating, like Ferguson of Washington State, the new governor. I mean, when you go back and say, you began your insurrection on this particular day, and because you continued and continued and continued, and nobody was, you know, there was nobody willing to enforce the law until now, we're retroactively going back and stripping you of all your pay, emoluments, and everything you receive from being in office from this point when you directly violated your oath. Now, citizens, this is also this is also applicable on the citizen side, where anybody that is actually performing an insurrection against the Constitution, not the U.S. government. I mean, it's one thing to actually be calling out the government. Now, what would be an insurrection against the Constitution? If you're formally involved in the Constitution or the Communist Party, the Communist Party or communist efforts of resistance against the laws of the United States, out protesting against the laws of the United States, that is treason. That is unabashed and unvarnished and clearly unadulterated treason against the United States. And I say this because the Whiskey Rebellion itself was viewed as treason, and two of the men that participated in it were found guilty. Therefore, what they should have done is they should have been actually hanged, but Washington waived that because these men were found guilty in a court. Bottom line, I think to expedite the process, I believe that the bulk of most all of these people need to be stripped of their citizenship, and they need to be notified that if they, as a inhabitant in the United States, continue to actually promote anarchy and violations of the Constitution, they will be deported and stripped. Now, I believe that there are citizens that have been gainfully and directly involved in insurgencies against the United States. Bill Gates is a great example, and most all of the billionaires in the United States have been guilty. And I believe that, you know, there's really no hope for Bill Gates because he has been out in front in being involved in global government and trying to subjugate the United States or the World Health Organization, so forth and so on. So he needs to be stripped of his citizenship and of everything he possesses and owns. And he needs to basically be put down into, you know, some sackcloth. Not even, he can't even sell his clothes, and deport. And anybody that has supported these types of things that have been actually undermining our Constitution, folks, we got to get rid of them. The understanding of the Tory Acts, which is why we started this year going through those in a painstaking way. These people that are out to basically undermine our government cannot be permitted to stay here. And they're using their resources to do this. Now, I would be at least okay with stripping some and allowing them to stay, because one of the things that we need to do is make sure that they don't have the means to continue. So I'm really more of an advocate of just kind of purging all those people, because 9 times out of 10, affluence is a very evil way of corrupting people. And this is how our governments in the states and federal governments, it's the affluence that is always the problem, which is why I'm here to tell you that a part of, you know, this is, I'm going down a rat hole here, but forgive me. The importance of making all elections local. If you do not understand that, you need to write that down and say, what is making all elections local? Because Trump needs to go back to, you know, if he's going to reframe the, or I should say restore our election system and the election integrity, it has to be done by making all elections local. And I'm not going to dive into that at this point because I'm really focused on this. So Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is clear. There's no mention that you're to be impeached. As a matter of fact, Section 3, when it comes to violating your oath, it removes any language of you need to be impeached. If you violate your oath of office, Section 3 kicks in. You're no longer eligible. It's an eligibility standard. You're no longer eligible or qualified to be in office because you have violated your oath. Period. Done. So you don't get any pay. You're removed. And this is how the impeachment process needs to be used against all of our former presidents because they need to be stripped of all of their emoluments because of their treason against the United States. Now, I believe Trump, because of his ignorance. Now, I've said this in 2016 during his candidacy and through his presidency, that it's ironic that the most ignorant person on the Constitution, because he's a businessman, he does not understand. He relies upon everybody else to tell him. And he's not getting good advice. He has lawyers that make up these crappy executive orders to repudiate some case when actually the real damage is the fact that the courts have assumed that they can create law. They can't. And as a matter of fact, that's why that first paragraph, getting back to this, that's why that first paragraph has to be completely changed. And basically then the next paragraph or subparagraph to this paragraph needs to go after the federal and state courts to draw the line and say any jurist that chooses to go down this path of trying to sustain law that has come from the bench and utilize the definitions that have been provided by the bench in changing the law will be equally guilty of violating the law. Therefore, they will be removed immediately without due process. Now, remember, they're not being locked up. They could stand trial for criminal behavior and so forth, but they're not being locked up. They're not losing liberty. They're not losing life. They're not losing property. They're just being removed from their service. Their service is no longer needed. Now, this is going to open up a lot of opportunities, folks. Those people who understand the Constitution will easily be able to step up and provide assistance in this, I don't want to even call it a revolution. It's not a revolution. It's a restoration. It's a reclamation. It's reclaiming the government that we actually have a birthright to. This is all a facade. When the people out there telling you that this corporate government is legitimate and this is what you got to do in response to it, they've convinced you that it's legitimate, and it's not. We have to oppose it. We have to oppose these infractions. We don't buy into it and take a different action and remove ourselves. You go down the path of becoming a sovereign national, whatever you want to call yourself. You no longer have the entitlement to voting. You no longer are a citizen and should not enjoy the benefits thereof. Now, right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, there are processes of dealing with this, but that is a different story. Let me get back into what Trump said in his next paragraph. But the fourth, so let me kind of conclude, people of African descent from eligibility are, which misinterpreted the Constitution as permanently excluding people of African descent from eligibility of United States citizens solely based on their race. So one of the problems that he also didn't include in this is the fact that Indians, Native Americans, were actually brought under that same definition, even though everybody only wanted to apply it to Black Africans, it actually did apply to Indians. Because that's a different voting block. And right now, I'll just say, aggrandizing of this national sovereignty, which is unconstitutional within the United States, this national sovereignty of the Indian nations, because the 14th Amendment made them citizens. So they're dual citizens. You can't create a state within a state. The Constitution doesn't allow that. It basically says admitting states into the union has to be, and states have to be fully autonomous within their own borders. So creating a state within that state, the federal government doing this, was in so many different ways violating the Constitution because of maybe their hate and animosity, the politics, whatever they were doing over the past centuries. The time to fix all of this is now. The time to get it all fixed and get it right. Because there's too much stuff to do. We've got too many things to get done so that we can actually, you know, start leading the world on liberty and show and watch how great America really becomes when it's unleashed all of the controls and regulations that are strangling it. Every state in the union is being strangled by federal regulations. Anyway, back to the next paragraph. But the 14th Amendment has never been interpreted to extend citizenship universally to everyone born within the United States. The 14th Amendment has always excluded from birthright citizenship persons who were born in the United States but not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Consistent with this understanding, the Congress has further specified through legislation that, quote, a person in the United States and a subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a national and citizen of the United States at birth, generally mirroring the 14th Amendment in its text. Now, I'm going to go through and basically tell you that as I see this, there is never a reference to the natural born citizen. And so what I'm going to do at this point, because it needs to be included into this, how did the anchor baby actually get injected into the Constitution, right? And so It's the anchor baby. The first use of all borns. Let me find anchor. So forgive me, folks. As a matter of fact, I actually have it in a browser, so I won't have to make you wait. I can just dive into this. Okay, so the anchor baby definition, where did it come from? And this idea that any person that could be, you know, make it here and have their baby, drop a baby on U.S. soil, that baby becomes a U.S. citizen. Now, you actually heard Tammy talk about this because she believed that that's how it was. And as I explained to her, that would be antithetical to civil law because, I mean, law that would be harmonious to a civil society. Because what you're doing is you're actually severing the parental relationship to that child. That child is a byproduct of the parents, and therefore they are under the jurisdiction of those parents and the nationality that those parents possess, the jurisdiction of that nationality. So, in an article, and you can find these things, this is the anchor baby birthright and the 14th Amendment, because what this does is it breaks down this concept that the anchor baby was and how it was created unconstitutionally. Now, all persons, this is the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to, so if you're born in the United States or if you're naturalized, obviously you're going to be a citizen. But if you're born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. So that's the language of Section 1, the first clause. Babies born to illegal alien mothers within the U.S. borders are called anchor babies because under the 1965 Immigration Act, it acts as an anchor that pulls the illegal alien mother and eventually the host of relatives into permanent U.S. residency under this jackpot babies is another term. Post-Civil War reforms focused on injustices to African Americans. The 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868 to protect the rights of native-born Black Americans whose rights were being denied, flagrantly being denied, and being killed. As recently as the freed slaves had, you know, basically suffered in 1868, a massacre in New Orleans. I've covered this. It was written in a manner so as to prevent state governments from ever denying citizenship to Blacks, including Indians, born in the United States. But in 1868, the United States had no formal immigration policy or standard of recognizing this citizenship of people that have been born and have been living under the jurisdiction of the United States that were not U.S. citizens. Senator Jacob Howard worked closely, and I reference Howard in a lot of the citations that I use regarding the 14th Amendment. Senator Howard worked closely with Abraham Lincoln in drafting and passing the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which abolished slavery. He also served on the Senate Joint Committee on Reconstruction, which drafted the 14th Amendment. And technically, what really drafted this clause was not in the 14th Amendment originally. They're skipping over something here. This little report I'm reading from the Concerned Americans, Our Independent Republic and Our Constitution. They're missing something. The language of the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States, that basic language was in the Civil Rights Act of 1866. It was not included into the 14th Amendment. And as a matter of fact, I actually have the original language of the Section 1 in the 14th Amendment and the congressional debates. This was what it stated, that no state shall make or enforce any law. That, in other words, that citizen clause was not there on April 30th, the first time that that paragraph, or I should say Section 1, was laid in the congressional debates. Didn't exist. It existed previously in the Civil Rights Act. It was not included into this, okay? So the first time, the first use of all persons born to be added or amended to Section 1 was on April 28th, okay? So that's when they first, or actually, forgive me, I believe, was that April 28th? So, because I said April 30th was the first time the full section. So I got to look at this because I think that this is backwards. I think it's May 28th. I hate doing this because I'm flying with all of these notes and so forth. Bottom line, it was Senator Howard, and no, it was May 28th. I'm correct. It was Senator Howard that basically laid this, and he made this statement. This is what he said. I will state very briefly what they are. I propose to amend Section 1 of the article, and it's clear, I clearly denote it here on the 28th of May. So it was a month later when Section 1 was actually inserted as a part of the workup of the 14th Amendment. It wasn't until a month later where they adjoined this part out of the Civil Rights Act to the 14th Amendment. All persons born in the United States subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states where they reside. And so this was formally read into Congress on May 30th, okay? So a few days later. And so bottom line, the First Amendment, or I should say the first section of the 14th Amendment, didn't really come to be regarding the citizenship. Why did they have to do this? Again, as the Trump executive order points out, it was to repudiate, but no. What it really does, and what really the whole point of the 14th Amendment, was to make it impossible for the court to change this. By galvanizing this, the court could not make these rulings and violate the Constitution. And Section 3 was to protect, you know, the people and these rights from the courts being able to try to legislate and changing these things, because Section 3 basically says, you want to try to redefine stuff? That's an insurrection and you're gone. If you look at the language of Section 3, and I have this, I would recommend my article, The Unseen Teeth of the 14th Amendment. I lay out the date of what the original language was of Section 3, and I'm running out of time, so we're going to have to extend this into Monday. But if you read the original language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and then you dive into the final language of what we see in the Constitution, you'll be amazed to recognize that it was not about the actual civilian rebellion, or I should say the Southern rebellion against the Constitution. They changed it to make sure going forward that the Constitution must be complied to by all public servants. They realized that not to just punish, but they wanted to make sure it never happened again. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.